We're delighted to have this month's speaker with us. Back in November of 2002, according to reporters, it's been a legend ever since that November night, that going around among reporters that our speaker today, when he learned that he had in fact been elected governor, was a little surprised. Now, I don't know if that's true, because I was in the other headquarters that night, and I can tell you, they were surprised. Since then, our speaker has jumped into a long list of issues of vital importance to this state, and he certainly has given us a great deal to write about with his ideas, and certainly with the responses that have come, both pro and con, to those ideas, and his work with the legislature in trying to get them through. He came right in at a time when state revenues were not meeting state expenses. There was a shortfall, so immediately he had to do what any new governor hates to do and go to work on taxes. It was followed by tort reform, work on the flag, faith-based initiatives, Hope Scholarship, education, his proposal for graduation coaches in middle schools. And most recently, of course, although it's been going on for a long time through several administrations, an ongoing concern, water, which he has told us he started working on even before he was inaugurated. Water, of course, is one that continues even as we speak. I know you have water at your table, so don't forget to drink it, because the governor's asked us all to conserve. And most recently, the legislature has brought him back full circle to taxes again. When I asked a few months ago if the governor would be willing to join us for a newsmaker lunch here at the Atlanta Press Club, the response was immediately, "We would love to do it." And we at the Press Club can't tell you how much we appreciate that. Please join me in welcoming Georgia's governor, Sonny Perdue.
Thank you very much. Dennis, I don't know who told you I'd love to do it, but they lied. I think the ground rules are about this. Everything I say today is 100% off the record. Isn't that the way it works? Teasing everyone. But thank you for that litany of issues that we've dealt with, Dennis. And the good news is that Dennis O'Hare has finally stopped asking me the flag question. So we're glad to talk about water. I think it was Ben Franklin that may have first said this, that there are two certainties in life, and one of those is death, and one of those is taxes. So today, I want to talk to you about what sometimes can be the less pleasant of the two, taxes. That just went right over your head. It's not an easy subject to broach, because most everyone feels very strongly about taxes, and I think we probably can all agree that no one really likes them, but we all agree that essentially they are possibly an ugly necessity. Our country's very independence, if you recall, was created essentially in the aftermath of a tax dispute, and though we've planned well to make Georgia's economy and tax revenues strong and stable, there's some who seem fairly eager to shift Georgia's tax structure dramatically this year. In the context of discussing taxes, and I have the same principle for many other issues, I think we should all remember the first most important rule taught to medical students. That is primum non nocere. First of all, do no harm. And some of you reporters in the room might remember that a year ago, renowned economist Arthur Laffer issued a report. And that report did rank Georgia, first among the 50 states for our competitive economic environment. The report wrote, and I quote, "Georgia has achieved its top rating through good performance virtually across the board in the 7 economic factors." And also noted, quote, "that the focus of the study and therefore the basis of our rankings is taxation." Now, Dr. Laffer isn't the only one that I think has recognized this. Georgia is consistently ranked high for economic growth and business-friendly environment. In fact, on Friday, it was reported again that Site Selection Magazine's latest study ranks Georgia as the second best business climate in the nation, up from number 4 last year. CNBC has also ranked Georgia number 4 as the best business climate in the nation. The Laffer study and Site Selection rankings demonstrate, I believe, how Georgia is recognized nationally for our low and balanced and fair tax system in our state. I believe these studies say that Georgia, thankfully, is not in a position where we have to gamble or take risk with our revenue stream. I think maybe in Las Vegas terms, I take that as we don't have to double down. We've got the luxury of time on our side, and we need to use that time to ensure that first do no harm is certainly in tax reform. Any talk about changing the revenue stream for an organization that serves our entire state, 9.3 million Georgians and growing every day, needs to be a thoughtful, deliberative discussion. We need to weigh all of our options carefully, and we need to ask the tough questions of ourselves. I think we need to have 100% confidence in all the changes the plan would bring, to be fully prepared for all the consequences and circumstances that might arise from that revenue stream. The questions I'm talking about, I believe, are fairly basic, fundamental queries that should be addressed before any action, be it changing a state's revenue stream or making a family decision. In fact, when you hear these questions, it almost sounds like, for you Rotarians, the 4-way test. Standard questions of any tax plan include things such as, is it fair? A tax system to be accepted needs to be equitable so that similarly situated taxpayers are taxed similarly. Now, that's important. It's important morally, and it's important ethically, and I think it's important economically. Secondly, is it feasible? Are we making reasonable assumptions? Can we continue to minimize state taxes while still funding services? Is it enough? Does it balance? In Georgia, you know, as in many states, we have a balanced budget amendment or balanced budget requirement in our Constitution. I think that's healthy. I think it forced us in 2002, 2003, 2004 to make the kinds of decisions that we needed to make in order to do the things that matched our revenue and our expenditure. And most of it, since our expenditure was going down, that meant tightening our belt and living within our means. So, is it fair? Thirdly, is it reliable? The state needs a stable revenue stream to fund necessities, regardless of economic upswings or downswings. We need predictability. We need for it to be there when we need it without the vagaries of the economy, or to minimize those vagaries. Is it efficient? Is it easily collectible? Is it administratively simple to collect this tax, and can you do it efficiently? I do believe that state government should collect taxes in the most efficient and effective way possible, and at the level of government where those services are delivered, and I believe it could be most responsive to local needs. And of course, fifthly, we always have to look out for this. We were talking at our table about economic development. Will it allow us to grow? Will it capture the economy, the growth of our state? Will it incentivize people to come to our state? frankly, a lot of the problems that we are experiencing today in congestion and transportation are a result of our state's popularity and the growth that we've had. It's stunning to me to think the state of Georgia, our state, in this decade is the third fastest growing state in the nation, percentage-wise, only behind two smaller states, Arizona and Nevada. Think about this. Georgia, in this decade, of the first decade of the 21st century, has outgrown Florida, Texas, California, New York. And I believe we know we're the ninth largest state. I think with those projections continuing, we will be the fifth largest state in the union in the not too distant future. So will it allow us to grow? Quite simply, a low tax burden attracts residents and businesses. People come for opportunity. It helps to create a business-friendly environment, in which in one of the qualities it brings employers and creates jobs in Georgia. Had a wonderful announcement just this morning of a Portuguese company, Effacet, $100 million investment in Effingham County, about 300 employees, and we're harvesting those week by week, and we have a lot of prospects on the list. Now, I want to be clear. I am not talking about necessarily anyone other's ideas about reforming our tax structure as all bad. I think when you look at the growth of the economy from services and other things, I think economists can tell you that we have not captured the breadth of that economy as if you broaden the sales tax base. What I am saying, and I want to say very clearly, is that any change to the state's revenue stream needs to be closely examined and analyzed factually for soundness. That brings me to another important concept and precept for medical students called the Hippocratic Oath. Doctors swear to do no harm, and they also remember that prevention is preferable to cure. It's interesting, as we are looking at this proposal weeks after voting to expand their sales tax services under duress because of falling revenue, Michigan's legislature is now looking to repeal that tax in the face of public scrutiny. We know about our neighbor to the south, experienced Florida in the 80s when a service tax was enacted and was almost as quickly repealed within 6 months in Florida. Ladies and gentlemen, I think we're saying that I don't believe we want to rush into treating Georgia's tax system with a cure that will need to be corrected or repealed a few months or a few years down the road. We want to avoid fiscal emergencies, not to fix them after they occur. And I believe we can do this by approaching the tax policy with an inclusive approach, soliciting input from stakeholders, working to ensure that everyone, state leaders, local leaders, the public alike, has a solid and sound understanding of the impact. I guess I've come to one conclusion in looking at the balance of our revenue system, compared particularly to states around us and states across the nation. And I think it's validated by those studies that I've mentioned before. I don't necessarily think Georgia's tax system is broken in a crisis. On the other hand, a number of states across the country are experiencing serious issues with revenue collection. The Florida legislature just wrapped up a special session to determine how to handle an unexpected $1 billion-plus revenue shortfall. Alabama, California, Nevada, Virginia, Michigan are all other states facing serious shortfalls. While we continue to manage our resources conservatively, Georgia is in pretty good shape. We aren't facing the funding crises that other states are dealing with, and we don't need to create one in our state by shifting revenue sources from more stable streams of revenue to more volatile streams of revenue. Georgia's sales tax revenues are showing signs of slowing. I think it's unmistakable to know that with the housing market down and as much emphasis as the construction, as much impact as the construction has on our economy in Georgia, it's only realistic to understand that they're showing signs of slowing. They're not dropping, but they are growing at a slower rate than they were last year and a slower rate than we budgeted for this year. Now, I want to make it clear that I am not promoting absolute inaction or doing nothing. I do have some ideas on ways to improve our tax system, but I'd like it to be for them to be considered in an inclusive atmosphere. I think there are ways that we can look at property tax assessments. What is a reasonable growth strategy for that? How do we help homeowners who face rapid, substantial escalations in these assessments in many years? We should be thinking about the impact and the value of ad valorem taxes in many ways, including automobiles. I'd like to see us in the state have a thoughtful consideration of the impact of expanding the sales tax base, but I want us to consider each of these fully in context with all the facts. But we've recently heard about sales tax revenues dropping across the country. As I said, particularly in our neighbor to the south who doesn't have an income tax and is very dependent upon sales tax, I think we need to be very prudent in our decision to shift about $9 billion from property taxes over to sales taxes without serious study. Right now, as you know, there's an idea out there to do that. And frankly, it's taken a lot of your ink and a lot of conversation throughout the fall or the spring and summer. But I visited with a House caucus this morning. I visited with a speaker last Friday morning. Once again, seeking numbers to see how this would impact our citizens. We talked about a few of those things on Friday, and I'm hoping to see the big picture today come from that several months after this proposal was placed out there. Now, some people, I guess, would consider me to be a boring, facts-based decision maker. But folks, when it comes to the revenue stream of our state and the importance, I think that's what our citizens expect. And so I look forward to looking at this idea exhaustively. I want to be very clear on the fact that as I understand the proposal, it is a shift of taxes rather necessarily than a tax cut. And I believe the people understand the difference between shifting a tax from one revenue source to another and removing a tax altogether. In fact, what I find primarily among the public, surprisingly, when it comes to taxes, they don't necessarily trust us, particularly when you start moving from A to B. As human nature is, those who are immediate losers recognize their loss very quickly and speak very loudly. Those who may be winners don't really believe it until years after the fact of whether they are successful or not. So there's some political risk in tax shifting. People understand elimination. They understand tax cuts. But a tax shift means that people, corporations, still pay the tax. They just pay it in a different way on different things. I believe that the public, if our economy remains strong, would prefer a tax cut in which they can have confidence. It's interesting that last session I proposed one, and I will propose one again this year, the senior income tax cut. I believe this is a tax cut that we can absorb economically as we ratchet down the revenue stream, enjoying the growth that we've had, and one that is economically sound. Eliminating income tax for Georgia seniors will help attract retirees to our state and keep retirees who have had a wonderful career here from leaving to other tax plans while providing tax relief to our citizens. On Friday, I received a letter from some organizations that I have a lot of respect for. They represent probably thousands of Georgians. They are members of 15 reputable groups like the Georgia Municipal Association, the Police Chiefs Association, the school boards, the Georgia Sheriff's Association, Association of County Commissioners, the AARP, the League of Women Voters. They're expressing concerns over proposed changes to Georgia's tax system. The letter goes on to say that any tax reform effort should ensure adequate revenues, maintain local control, and be fair, simple, and predictable, many of the principles that I talked about. They agree that this issue needs to be thoroughly dissected before any action is taken. And ladies and gentlemen, I believe it is time for us to ask these questions, to step back and to get a wider view of the situation of where we are. As a leader, I am well aware that different situations call for different actions. The first role of a leader is to protect, defend, and to stabilize. Sometimes this calls for an academic, analytical, fact-finding approach. On the other hand, sometimes urgent issues present themselves and call for quick, decisive action necessary to create that stability. That's frankly what we did in the water crisis. This situation is critical, and we call for immediate action. As Dennis indicated, in 2002, before I was even sworn in as governor, I spoke with Jeb Bush to see if we could work out a deal to this water war that had been raging for our states for years, and invited him and Governor Riley to a meeting. I've also met with his predecessor, Governor Crist, as well as Governor Riley, and several times, particularly Governor Riley in the ACT. Despite the progress that we made and the understanding that I believe we had, we were not able to ink a deal. A month ago, the Corps' own computer modeling showed that if they continued on the same course, Georgia faced a serious risk of our reservoirs being drained of all conservation storage. In response, we formulated a plan to alter the interim operating plan to extend our water resources to maintain energy production and to protect the endangered species downstream. When that solution was turned down or essentially ignored, we filed an injunction against the Army Corps of Engineers to end the senseless relief of 3.2 billion gallons of water a day from our reservoirs. Let me put this in context, 3.2 billion gallons. You all, the number that, the tail that was wagging the dog on this issue was 5,000 cubic feet per second over the Woodruff Dam at Lake Seminole going into the Apalachicola River. This is where the Flint River and the Chattahoochee come together, form the Lake Seminole, and then flow over the dam. That had been the determination that had been there for years, really not scientifically tested. But that was backing up the reservoir management all the way up, 5,000 CFS. Let me put that in context. The total net consumption of the metro area in these basins is a little over 500 CFS. Now, there's a lot of paranoia in Alabama, frankly, even in South Georgia, that Atlanta is growing and just consuming all the water. The numbers, if you're facts-based, indicate otherwise, that consumption, the net consumption, is a little over 500, and we were trying to reach a flow of 5,000. And that's what we wanted to call attention to. Using the only tool that I believe at my disposal, since we were not able to get our federal partners to sit down and to deal with this in a reasonable way, I declared an emergency in those 85 counties due to the threat of water supply in the northern part of our state. I asked the president to declare a major disaster area in Georgia to utilize his power under the Endangered Species Act to prevent catastrophic harm to the state. And last week, I met with Senators Isaacson and Chambliss, as well as Governor Riley and Governor Crist, the Secretary of the Interior, Governor Dirk Kempthorne, former governor of Idaho, in a water-scarce region, to receive the Corps' specific response and recommended short-term changes to the IOP. As a result of, I think, our calling the question, the Army Corps and the other states have agreed to a temporary flow from Lake Lanier. More importantly, I believe, or it's a particularly the nonsensical portion under that interim operating plan that said if it begins to rain, you can't really store that rainfall. It goes on down as well, up to double that from 5,000 to 10,000. Folks, when I'm asking Georgians to conserve and to cut back, and we can't store what God blesses us with, that really got under my skin. They relented on that and will allow us to store the rainfall that we get now. We've also discussed in that meeting how the three governors and our federal partners might come together to really create a short-term and long-term water sharing plan that can be the basis for a long-term resolution for these water wars. We're working on mitigating the effects of this current drought, but we cannot lose sight of Georgia's long-term water needs. Now is the time to prepare for Georgia's future water demands. As you know, we've worked over the past few years to develop a comprehensive statewide water plan to help guide Georgia and all of its watersheds in managing our water resources in a long-term sustainable manner. The Water Council, headed by Dr. Carol Couch, is working to refine the plan in an inclusive fashion, cohesive solution that will lay out statewide water management practices, policies, and principles, and will give guidance for the development of regional water plans. They're listening and responding to stakeholder input, trying to come up with the best plan possible. And I'm confident that Georgia will come out of this crisis stronger and better prepared than ever before. I believe the essence of leadership is an understanding of the difference between situations that call for quick, decisive action and those that call for serious scrutiny. I can tell you this, every bill that crosses my desk, every decision I'm asked to make, every proposal that's floated my way, each of those are considered with the precept of first, do no harm. Georgia will continue to take swift action when we need to, and we will continue to step back and conduct thoughtful, serious study before we act when the situation calls for scrutiny. We're working to make our state an even better one. We want to make the decisions that we make to be smart, and the solutions that we find to be long-term. We want a state that will continue to serve us, our children, and future generations. And I believe in this thoughtful process that we're well on our way to achieving just that. I look forward to your questions.
Can you all hear me? Governor, thank you very much for being here. We've got maybe about 10 minutes for questions, and if you haven't gotten the cards in, by all means do so. We're going to take a couple of questions from the working media first, since the governor won't have time to address them afterwards.
Is that a euphemism?
It's a contradiction in terms, I mean. This is one that you touched on in your speech, and this is about the water. What safeguards would prevent Atlanta from drawing water from other river basins and harming the economic growth of downstream communities?
Well, again, permitting would be for one, and the principles that we have against interbasin transfers right now, the limitations in that area. in looking at the physics and the whole hydrology of the Chattahoochee system, for instance, Lake Lanier has a very, very small watershed draw catch basin, but it's the majority of the storage for that whole watershed. Puts an immense pressure on that, and so Lake Lanier has to be used as the charger for everything else. That's what's happening now with West Point. And and you follow Walker F. George as well. But last time we tried it, water still runs downhill. And you have to be careful in the complex management of that in order to preserve that. I'm not sure the harm that we're talking about bringing to other communities, but as governor of Georgia, I have to be just as concerned about the communities downstream as I am the metro area. And I think the good news is that in most times, this occasion probably occurs less than 0.1% of the history of the watershed, probably even less than that. I need to go back and calculate the days. We did that one time when we were dealing with previously. But most of the time we get good rain, good rainfall. It is the management of these reservoirs that we must be concerned about, as well as determining if we need additional storage capacity within our state, where that could best be located, and how we could best accomplish a better reservoir storage capacity to meet our long-term needs.
Next question also deals with water. Georgia, Florida, and Alabama have been battling the water issue for close to 20 years. There was a piece in the paper, I believe, this morning in which a lot of folks expressed skepticism that after all that time, we can reach a long-term water agreement by February 15th. What makes you feel that we can settle the issue now?
I think the reason I am optimistic, I'm usually an optimist, but I approached this both times as an optimist, and frankly, we did sign a memorandum of understanding with Governor Bush and Governor Riley in 2003. It was not consummated in an agreed-upon compact that we could take to our legislators. We frankly had an agreement with the governor of Alabama on the ACT. Let me give you a little context about what's important to who. Now, the ACT is composed of the Coosa and Tallapoosa, which flow into Alabama about the Rome area there. It has the reservoirs Allatoona and Lake Carter. The interesting thing, the reverse is true in that watershed, in that we have very a wider catch basin for those reservoirs, but we only have about 16% total of those reservoirs of the storage capacity in that. But that flow is important to Northeast Alabama, and that's what they're most concerned about. I agreed unilaterally to divorce those two watersheds when I approached Governor Riley over a year ago and said, let's see if we can resolve this one watershed at a time. And the fact is, what is at stake? The very essence of life, water to drink, is at stake in Georgia. We've got economic development issues. Frankly, water to assimilate for pollution purposes, water to cool energy plants, on the other hand, in Alabama. Florida has some environmental concerns, ostensibly about the mussel, but I really believe their economic interests are more for the oyster fishermen in Apalachicola Bay. So it is a degree of criticality of what's at stake, and it's not unlike the joke that you hear so many times about the chicken and the hog having ham and eggs and making a full commitment. For one, it's a contribution. For one, it's a real sacrifice. And it's a little bit, there's some distinction there regarding those type of critical issues in these reservoirs and what it means to Georgia versus what it means to the other. Therefore, if you're going to negotiate with someone about sharing agreements, you've got to have confidence that they really want a solution. And I'm hopeful that they want a solution, but I think they can best demonstrate that by coming to a solution in the near term with Georgia.
Two related questions. One is, there are folks in both, pretty much downstream in both Georgia and Alabama, who say that their interests were not represented in the water talks, and they say that they are paying for what they say is unregulated growth of Atlanta. And if this crisis continues, would that have a damaging effect on the business image of Georgia that you talked about during your speech?
Let me first of all acknowledge that there is a lot of paranoia about Atlanta. And frankly, to some degree, it comes from a jealousy in other places. I was baited in my campaign in 2002, since I was from Middle Georgia, to make this an anti-Atlanta campaign. I deferred from that because I believe I had the knowledge that Atlanta is a wonderful economic engine for our state as a whole. When I live in Bonair, Georgia, Atlanta matters to me. And the very fact that we don't have to pit one section again of this state against the other, even in water, the context, that's why I wanted to give you the context of consumption here. But the fact is, the reality is, the perception is that Atlanta still gets more than its share of jobs, of money, of water, of whatever it is, you name it. The perception in many areas, Alabama and other parts of Georgia, is that we are sacrificing because of Atlanta. I don't ascribe to that, and I don't believe that's the case. And I think we ought to deal with facts here, and that as governor of Georgia, when I swore an oath of allegiance to protect and defend the Constitution of the state, I didn't segment that into areas of the state. I'm not a product of Atlanta, and I am just as absolutely concerned about the other areas of the state and the multiplicity of needs that they have as I am here. But the criticality of this is, and the fact is, we don't have to pit ourselves against one another. I understand that's the way some people feel, and I'm not sure that I will or we will ever dispel them of that notion. But I'm going to continue trying with the facts that says that that paranoia has no basis in fact.
On the tax plan, there was a second part of that, and that was, would it damage the business image of Georgia that you talked about if this crisis continues as a good place to grow a business?
If you're a conspiratist or conspiracy theorist, you might think that may be some people's motives. Because we're doing pretty good right now.
On the tax plan, this would be a constitutional amendment in the legislature, the proposal that the House Republican leadership is talking about. And therefore, you're saying, let's slow down and study this. Question comes up, is there anything you can do? Since it's a constitutional amendment, if it's ratified by the two-thirds of the House and the Senate, at what point would you have any influence over it? And secondly, another question asks, we always talk about funding activities rather than reducing spending. Can spending ever be cut?
Answer to the first question was, can I have anything to influence? Yes. The second question is, when? Is now. And thirdly is, go back and look at 2002, 2003, and 2004 to see that the budget expenditure is literally over $1 billion. And I'm in the middle of budget hearings right now, and I'm holding tight against the kite in a public environment when there's adequate revenue that continues to want to fly higher and higher in every agency. It's a natural way of doing it, and Sonny's holding the reins down in that regard.
Quick question on Grady, since they're about to look at the possibility of going to a nonprofit. Is it possible that the state could support the 200 specialty clinics at Grady, and so that uninsured people throughout the state could use those clinics to treat critical illnesses?
I'm not aware of the 200 clinics outside the state. I think we've got to get the core business model corrected first. Once again, you need to understand that the state participates in the indigent care in several ways. And in Medicaid, very strongly, and in Peach Care for the low and middle income children, and certainly through our federal participation with taxation in Medicare. And we're doing it also through the Indigent Care Trust Fund, We're doing it through the disproportionate share for hospitals there. And nowhere in the state do we own a primary care hospital or a trauma hospital. We are in the mental care hospitals, and I'm not convinced we should be there. But the fact is, the state is not a good direct deliverer of care. How do you do for Grady on a statewide basis what you cannot afford to do for every hospital in the state and otherwise? This has to be a balanced approach. And the very fact is that there are other public hospitals that have transformed their governance model into what we're proposing and suggesting that Grady do, and frankly are doing very, very well in their communities. Augusta, Savannah, Albany, Macon, in the Northeast area. And they've done it very successfully through the reimbursement structure that we currently provide for through the state and all the reimbursement streams. And I'm suggesting to you that I think Grady can have not only a very functional, important delivery of health care in this region and this area, but they can do it with financial sustainability.
We have time for one more, and might as well talk about transportation since everybody had to find some way to get here. Do you plan to present a comprehensive transportation plan for Metro Atlanta and Georgia this year to the legislature? And if so, can you give us an advance peek of what the elements are?
This is one of those inclusive areas that I believe there should be recommendations for in an inclusive fashion. And I'm frankly invited the Speaker, the Lieutenant Governor this morning to come together and let's provide solutions to this area in terms of what needs to happen, what is the vision for the future, what part does transit play, and how can we make congestion relief a reality in the foreseeable future. And we've had really several, frankly, good studies that have occurred this past year. One of them about the value proposition that I had the accounting firm do. They've had a study over efficiency that the monitor group did. The legislature has looked at the funding stream. I think we should have enough data to come to a conclusion jointly about what some recommendations we all can agree on, and I hope that can happen. I can't give you a preview of that today, nor would I.
Well, we had to try anyway.
I understand. And we're not going back on the flag either, Dennis.
I didn't get to ask you. That is all the time we have. But before you go, please, a big thank you to Governor Sonny Perdue. Before you leave, let me just remind you of our next programs. Coming up, the next Newsmaker Lunch, November 16th. John Huey of Time Incorporated will be here. And don't forget our holiday author party. It's always a tremendous event, and that'll be December 5th at the New World of Coca-Cola. Thanks to our sponsors. Thanks to all of you, and have a great afternoon.